Me personally, I think healthcare should be free for all Americans. That's just my opinion. Yeah. For you guys who didn't clap, that means you can't relate. Let me tell you something. It's messed up when you're too broke to go to the doctors. You know you should be at the doctors, but instead you in CVS at 2 o'clock in the morning trying to diagnose yourself. You be walking in like, oh, shit. My kidneys are messed up. I better get me some NyQuil. Can't hurt NyQuil is good for bad kidneys. Let me get some Tums for this tumor I got, too. You know, Tums is in the word tumors.
That was award-winning comic actor Reuben Paul. This is The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Humor affects many things: our health, our disposition, our relationships, and our organizations. Can it also help to change politics and society? With us are three experts. Amber Day is a professor of performance studies in the English and Cultural Studies Department at Bryant University. She's the author of Satire and Dissent, Interventions in Contemporary Political Debate, and Breaking Boundaries in Politics and Political Entertainment Studies. John Morrill is professor of philosophy and department chair of religious studies at William & Mary College. He is the founder of International Society for Humor Studies and the author of Comic Relief, A Comprehensive Philosophy of Humor, and The Philosophy of Laughter and Humor. Peter McGraw also joins us. Peter McGraw is a professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He directs the Humor Research Lab and co-directs the Moral Research Lab. He's the author of The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you. John Morrill, I'd like to start with you for a historic context. You've traced the origin of humor historically. You've looked at it even in animals. What does history tell us about humor?
Well, the current best theory, I think, of the evolution of humor is that it evolved from a rough-and-tumble kind of play in apes. Gorillas and chimpanzees, from whom we split in evolution about 6 million years ago, have a kind of laughter that's kind of hard to pick up because it's on the intake rather than the outtake. So instead of laughing ha-ha-ha, they laugh ah-ah-ah. It's kind of like panting. And what it accompanies is mock wrestling, chasing and biting, the kind of things that you do with a little kid. And just as with a little child, when chimps and gorillas chase each other and wrestle each other to the ground and pretend that they're aggressive, they give a signal that they're only playing, and that signal is laughter. So for me, the best theory of the evolution of laughter and humor is that they came from a kind of rough-and-tumble play where it was necessary that they signal to the other person, look, I'm not out to hurt you. I'm not out to break your skin when I pretend to bite you, for example. And that laughter was this play signal. You can see this today when somebody tries to be funny, but they don't give any indication that you're trying to be funny. Well, what that usually ends up in is being threatening. The great example of that was Andy Kaufman, who for years after he left Saturday Night Live went around the country challenging women to wrestle him and defeat him, but he didn't put it in any kind of play frame. He didn't give any comedic hints that he was only playing. So he would show up these wrestling places, and he'd have women who really took him seriously and really wanted to hurt him. So when we are playing and when we want to engage in humor, we need laughter to signal that we're only playing.
Peter McGraw.
So what John says is, I think, is absolutely right, that the origins of humor started with play, but as humans developed and started to have other sorts of rules, new linguistic rules and cultural rules and societal rules, the things that became threatening or that could become wrong started to expand. And so the things that we find funny now have moved beyond the physical. Now it can be toilet humor, things like puns, moving outside of that, satire, irony, sarcasm, and so on. And the work that we've been doing in the Humor Research Lab has identified an explanation for that, something that we call benign violations, that we tend to laugh at, we are delighted by, amused by situations that seem both wrong and okay, in the same way that rough and tumble play is playful and fun when it's both a violation, there's some threat, and then also some idea of, oh, this is okay, this is safe, this is playful. And so this evolution has moved up and branched out and has created what is really a complex yet exciting topic of research.
Amber Day, in your introduction, you look at various kinds of satire. And one of the things that you noted in your, I think it was in the literature review, was that it used to be really the art of the aristocrats, but now it's like a tool for the populist.
So that's how it sort of grossly gets characterized. I don't know that that's entirely true across the board. I think there was, for a long time, literary scholars considered it a conservative art form because it was used in that way. I think there's certainly examples that go against that grain. But there's definitely, you know, there's power in humor, and I think it can be used in either direction. So you can use it certainly to sort of put people in their place and remind them of the status quo and that they're stepping outside of it and using it for ridicule, and that tends to be from top down. But you can certainly also use it to question and to deconstruct the official line and, you know, to point out ironies, and that tends to be more of a sort of subversive bottom up.
Ironies, absurdities, but then, yes, you know, the idea of laughing at rather than laughing with.
Is certainly different than the sort of evolutionary start of it, in a way.
When we talk about laughing at versus laughing with, Peter McGraw, I think you were the one who wrote the piece on partisanship and humor. First of all, it sounded like the left won the humor quotient, hands down, but they have different preferences for humor. Conservatives like one kind of humor and liberals like another. Can you break that down for us?
Certainly. The intuition is that the Democrats are the funny party. But I think to Amber's point, a lot of that is the sort of laughing at, the attacking the traditions and attacking those people in power. But when it comes to being funny, more generally, liberals and conservatives seem to be more equal. It's not clear that there's good evidence that liberals are funnier people. And some work done by Dan Ariely reveals that. That in some ways, depending on the topic, conservatives really have a much better time. I think that follows what we tend to find, this idea that benign violations is subjective. It depends on your values and your beliefs and your experiences. So what's funny to one person is not funny to another. And as a result, in some sense, everybody's funny. Everybody has equal opportunity to be funny, whether or not they're a liberal or a conservative.
And then, of course, there's just the infectiousness of Joe Biden laughing the entire time during his vice presidential debate with Paul Ryan.
Indeed. Yeah, and that's certainly a case where he was using laughter as ridicule.
So in this case, you think he was laughing at Paul Ryan?
Well, I think that he was using laughter to point out the ridiculousness, the absurdities of the things that Ryan was saying, and in a way that was designed to kind of resonate with his party.
John Morrell, let's bring you back in here. Now, you've looked at this philosophically, and you say that we really value comic characters more than other types of heroes, like the tragic hero. First of all, tell us why that is, and then walk us through the Barack Obama kind of comic role.
Sure. One of the things that I've studied is the contrast between the heroic tradition, which lasted in American politics well into the 20th century. People like, well, take a turn of the century president like William Howard Taft or even the early Teddy Roosevelt. These people were frequently military veterans, or Eisenhower would be an even better example. These are people who were often military veterans, and they were part of a long tradition that goes back to the ancient Greeks, where the leader is somebody who tries to maximize power. They try to maximize their own knowledge. They try to be on top of everything. And they typically don't laugh very much at themselves. There's a newer style of leadership, which has grown up in the U.S. and throughout the world in the last 30 years or so, which I call post-heroic. And in this style of leadership, you don't emphasize the difference between you and the people you govern. In corporations, for example, in the last 30 years, they've leveled the pyramid. That is, that they've cut out a lot of the levels of organization. And so you see CEOs talking to ordinary people on the manufacturing line. The newer style of leadership tends to have a lot more humor in it. When I do talks like this for political groups and business groups, I often use William Howard Taft, who was not only a very kind of a stuffy president, but he was also our nation's fattest president. On the day of his inauguration, he weighed something over 300 pounds, and there was a new bathtub in the White House, and he got stuck in the tub, and it took four guys over 2 hours to extricate him from the tub. But he swore everybody to secrecy because he wouldn't want the population of the U.S. laughing at him. If you contrast that with somebody like Barack Obama, Obama isn't the funniest guy in the world, but he can certainly poke fun at himself. One of my favorite examples was between the time he was elected and his inauguration. He was in a press conference, and they were throwing him all kinds of tough questions about the economy, which was in a shambles, and all kinds of stuff. And finally, somebody threw him a softball question, and they said, "We hear that you're going to get a dog for the White House for your daughters. What kind of dog are you going to get?" And Obama said, "Well, at first we thought we wanted to get a mutt." And then he said, "Like me." And to me, that was just a watershed moment for a president to say a mutt and then like me, because he's half black, he's half white. It showed a guy who could poke fun at himself. And that kind of leadership is found not just in politics, but also in business. If you look at CEOs today, for example, versus, say, 50 years ago, they've removed the tie. A lot of them have also removed the sport jacket or the suit jacket. And the hero of this movement is Herb Kelleher of Southwest Airlines, who's built a very successful corporation, largely on his playfulness, his sense of humor, and his ability to link both of those to spirit of camaraderie and equality. Humor tends to level differences between people. So when a president or a CEO or your boss can engage in really open humor, I'm not talking about sarcasm or put down, but really open humor, everybody can relax and social relations go a lot better.
Amber Day, this is a perfect place to bring you in because you've looked at this as a form of dissent also, and you've studied all kinds of political dissent, whether it was satire or some other kinds of activism. How do you see this now shaping the political landscape with the new satirists in town?
Sure. I found that last point really interesting, and I kind of want to jump off of it because I feel like it's not just in leadership, but it's become more of a cultural norm to sort of to use a kind of self-deprecating or self-referential irony. And that in many circles, that somehow kind of signals an honesty or a trustworthiness. I think that's partially because of the way in which political discourse, in particular the sort of public debate, is so kind of stage managed, so perfect, so you know, shiny and fake in many ways, right? We all know the way it's staged, and yet there's this frustration in the way in which the press isn't doing the best job of getting through that, you know, getting past the talking points that have been pre-scripted and all of that. And so I think where a lot of the sort of interesting political satire is coming out these days and the hunger for it is this desire to see somebody actually kind of poke holes in that spectacle and do so in a way in which they're not necessarily an expert, but they're also kind of drawing attention to who they are and that they don't claim to be perfect and that they don't necessarily have all the answers. So there's a sort of humble irony employed there.
And you've noted that this has actually transformed at least some of our comics, our comedians, into really legitimate pundits, or at least semi-legitimate pundits.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, a figure like, you know, Jon Stewart, of course, is the first one to come to mind, is quite different than what's come before. A few decades ago, Chevy Chase was everybody really liked his impression of the presidents and they liked his Weekend Update shtick, but you would never ask Chevy Chase seriously for his take on contemporary politics. Nobody would think of doing so, but Jon Stewart is doing something quite different than what Chevy Chase was doing.
Right, and Jon Stewart happens to be quite learned and well-read and brilliant at the same time, which perhaps is what makes a great comic.
I think so. Well, you can be funny in many different ways, but the way in which he's funny and the things that resonate are because he is really sort of revealing things, pulling back the curtain on some of that political debate and some of the staged nature of political discourse and really letting us watch how it's put together in a way that's incredibly satisfying, I think.
Peter McGraw, that sort of touches on something that was in one of your blogs, which deals with the humor being sort of counter-establishment by its nature. And how do you see that fitting in with today's politics?
You know, one of the roots of sort of stand-up comedy, comedy is entertainment, comes out of the motif of the trickster, of the court jester. And on my Humor Code travels, my co-author Joel Warner and I met with Patch Adams. And I can't repeat the language that Patch used, but he basically said that the court jester is the only person who can call the king a jack, you know. And so he actually used more flavorful language than that. And that tradition continues today, where comedians, stand-up or otherwise, are taking aim at the things that are wrong with the traditions, with the people in power, with government, with media. And the Jon Stewarts of the world, they happen to be doing it, you know, better than anyone else, in part because Jon Stewart is really adept. He's quick on his feet. He's a quick thinker. He also has a writer's room full of very funny Harvard graduates who are helping him out along the way. And the very best comedians that we've found on the road are ones that can take aim at themselves, as John and Amber mentioned, in part to increase that level of credibility, that if they can make fun of themselves, then they certainly can make fun of all these other things that are wrong in the world.
John Morrell, let's bring you back in then. You've talked about the benefits of humor. It helps us individually. You've talked about various ways it helps organizations. How do you think it's beneficial for politics of the world?
It's interesting that the beginning of comedy was in the 5th century BCE in Athens, Greece. And the beginning of democracy was in 5th century Athens, Greece, 5th century BCE. I think that there's a very strong link between people being able to joke about their leaders, to poke fun at their shortcomings, their hypocrisy, their screw-ups, etc., and their political freedom. So I think that there's a strong link between open societies and democratic values and this ability to have people like Jon Stewart around. If you look at countries that are repressive, if you look, for example, at several countries in the Middle East, where joking about the leader can get you executed, you see the opposite of this. And in the West, probably the strongest example of somebody who repressed humor was Hitler. When Hitler was rising to power in the late 20s and early 30s, the first people who criticized him were stand-up comedians. At that time, they were called cabaret comics. And when Hitler came to power in 1933, one of the first things that he did was establish special courts for prosecuting people who made fun of his Third Reich or made fun of the brown shirts or made fun of the way the Nazis were told to march, etc. And over 100 people were executed. One stand-up comic in Berlin, for example, was executed. He was hanged for naming his horse Adolf. If you look at the Soviet Union, there was a similar pattern. The Soviet Union wanted to control humor and suppress humor that was critical of the leader. And they even set up a special journal, which came out every 10 days in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. It had a larger circulation than Time magazine and Newsweek magazine put together in this country, and it was called Crocodile. And what they allowed humor about was inefficiency, bureaucratic red tape, people being drunk on the job, people not doing their work. But what they didn't allow was jokes about the leadership. So the secretary of the Communist Party was never a legitimate target. So governments have known since the days of ancient Egypt, when the first court jesters were in place, that humor is powerful, and humor may be playful, but it can be playfully critical. And so governments that are more open allow for more humor. Governments that are more controlled and repressive are afraid of humor.
Amber Day, I don't recall if you actually had this in your literature or in your book, but can you tell us what kind of a measurable impact some of these new, what you called Renaissance comics, are making in society in America today or in the other countries that you looked at?
The short answer is no, but I think, yes, the problem is sort of how do you measure that effect, and that's the hardest thing to do, right? And I think we tend to sort of look at it very simplistically and say, well, is this one piece going to have a measurable effect on the next election? And the answer is usually no, of course it isn't. But I think these comics and, you know, a number of the filmmakers, the activists that I'm looking at are making a difference and they are doing something. But I think it's smaller. I think it's shifting the conversation in small ways, changing the terms in which we talk about particular issues, or even actually pushing issues that were very peripheral and only sort of talked about in marginal counterpublics, pushing those further into the wider public sphere and into the wider discussion. And I think that's huge. And that's the kind of thing, these shifts have to happen before change ever takes place, right? Because sort of public perception has to change, but it is the stuff that's incredibly hard to actually track and measure.
We do know from the, I think it's the Pew studies, that The Daily Show was certainly the leading source of news, political news for young people, particularly through the election periods.
Right.
Perhaps we should take a little shift and talk about, well, what makes things funny? And this is something that you've all looked at as well. Peter McGraw, that's kind of the whole subject of your institute. Why don't you start us with this? Why are some things funny and some things not?
So, yeah, so I recognize that some of my theorizing isn't always popular as a kind of outsider moving into this field. My expertise is in judgment and decision-making and the study of emotion more generally. And when I stumbled on this question, I surveyed the research, including John's work, and found hints at different perspectives, one that's different than the traditional view of humor arising from some form of incongruity, that there's some mismatch between what we expect and what we get in the world. And as I mentioned earlier, I, based on my reading, came to the conclusion that actually humor has a counterintuitive underpinning, that of something negative, what we call a violation. And luckily, there's support for this by people a lot smarter than me. Mark Twain has a great quote where he says that the secret source of humor is not joy, it's sorrow. There is no humor in heaven. That is because because heaven's perfect, there's nothing actually to laugh at. And the studies that we've been doing in the Humor Research Lab seem to help support that idea. But of course, the things that are violations don't normally amuse us. They upset us. And so you have to have this other judgment, this recognition that the situation is safe or acceptable or okay, or as we say, benign.
So then it really could collapse into the tragic.
So the tragic is actually a really good source of humor in many ways, but it also keeps with a saying that's at least been attributed to Mark Twain, that the humor is tragedy plus time, that as time passes, as you get some distance from the thing that's bad, it helps transform it from a violation into a benign violation.
And John Morrell, would you agree?
Yes. Peter's notion of a benign violation fits fairly well with the traditional theory called the incongruity theory, which says that in a humorous situation, something violates your expectations. You expect A and you get not A, or even better, you get the opposite of A. So your expectations are violated. That's part one. And part two is you don't go into a negative emotion. You don't get scared. You don't become sad or depressed. You're not disgusted or angry. Instead, you are able to enjoy the incongruity. You're able to enjoy this surprise. Humans are the only ones who can pull this off. You can surprise your cat, for example, by moving her food dish to a different spot in the kitchen. You can dress up in a funny Halloween costume in front of your dog, but you'll never get a laugh out of either one of them. So humans are the only ones who can experience something that they weren't ready for, even the opposite of what they were ready for. And even including their own disappointments and their own mistakes, and somehow enjoy it. They can have their mental train derailed and enjoy the train wreck. So Peter's notion of a violation, which is safe or okay or benign, I think it works very well. And you notice that in some situations, the same event which surprises, say, a room full of people, will make some of them angry and others of them amused. So I think there's a personal difference between people who go into a negative emotion versus people who go into laughter instead. And that's basically what Peter referred to quickly as distance. I call it mental distance. People who can laugh about things typically see it from a higher perspective. They step back. They're less emotionally engaged. People who tend to experience everything with anger or fear or sadness or depression tend to be emotionally wrapped up in things. And that's the heart of tragedy. The difference between tragedy and comedy isn't the subject matter. In comedy and in tragedy, the subject matter is disappointment and failure and suffering and death and our inability to understand what's happening to us. Comedy isn't about happy, successful people doing well. It's about the same thing tragedy is about. But the tragic character goes into her emotions. She gets swept away by them. The comic character steps back and thinks her way rather than feels her way through her problems.
Amber Day.
I would just add to that a little bit, but I don't think we should see comedy, humor, irony as completely removed from the serious or the feeling or, you know, feeling very strongly about something. Because there tends to be this assumption that, you know, somebody like Jon Stewart, well, it's bad for politics, right? It's cynical. And, you know, we're just laughing at it. We're not really caring about it. And I spend a lot of time sort of pushing against that assumption because I think what's really interesting about a lot of the political humor in particular that we see right now is a lot of it is actually very earnest, you know, and it's being used to rile us up to some degree, particularly in some of the activist groups that I take a look at, or some of the viral videos that we see circulating before an election. They tend to use irony and humor and satire to get our attention and to grab us. And I think there is that aspect of the benign violation because the satisfaction comes in knowing, wow, somebody else notices this, right? Somebody else is seeing this. And that makes me feel a little bit better. But I think the intended effect, a lot of the time, if it is being used to garner attention or to actively get people involved in something, is to get them mad, really, or to get them upset about it and feel like there are other people who are laughing at the same thing and who are upset about the same thing and that there's sort of that strength in numbers.
Thank you, all three of you, for joining us. John Morrell, Amber Day, Peter McGraw, it's great to have you here with us on the Scholar Circle. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Amber Day is a professor of performance studies in the English and Cultural Studies Department at Bryant University. She's the author of Satire and Dissent, Interventions in Contemporary Political Debate, and Breaking Boundaries in Politics and Political Entertainment Studies. John Morrell is professor of philosophy and department chair of religious studies at William & Mary College. He is the founder of International Society for Humor Studies and the author of Comic Relief, A Comprehensive Philosophy of Humor, and The Philosophy of Laughter and Humor. Peter McGraw is a professor of marketing and psychology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He directs the Humor Research Lab and co-directs the Moral Research Lab. He's the author of The Humor Code, A Global Search for What Makes Things Funny. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, Tim Page, and Kwatema Gailaman. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.